In jeans, a fisherman's sweater, and ballet flats, with her hair in a braid down her back, she looked like a kid. The two women were an interesting contrast, with Jane's long, lean, blonde good looks and Alex's dark pixie quality, which was her personality, too. They had shared some good laughs and lively times together. "Not so charming these days," Jane said about John with a sigh, as they finished lunch in the museum cafeteria. They both wanted to see a Calder exhibit that had just opened. He was a favorite of Jane's. "He's in such a shit mood, finishing up his papers and final projects. That's all he thinks about now. I haven't had dinner with him in a month." "I don't know what it is about guys. They can never multitask. It's all one thing or another, with no room for anything else." Alex had broken up with her last boyfriend a year before, and had just started dating a junior partner in the firm. And her parents had been nagging her about getting married for the past 2 years, since she turned 30. Jane's parents were more relaxed about it, for now. Her mother had started making comments about John, and questioning their plans for the future, but marriage just wasn't on her radar screen for now. Alex was a little more concerned in recent months, and had started talking about wanting kids. "Is the old magic still there?" she asked Jane, who thought about it for a moment before she answered. "To be honest, I don't know. I'm not sure we ever had magic. We like each other a lot. We like doing the same things. It was easy, and we get along. Or at least we used to. I guess if you put a gun to our heads, we'd say we love each other. But I don't think either of us are passionate people. Maybe we're too interested in our careers." Jane thought about it at times, but she had no real complaints about John either, except lately, with his intense study habits and no time for her, and her mild concerns about Kara and women who looked like her. Jane was wholesome and natural. She wasn't a sexy type or a femme fatale like Kara. John liked to talk about hot women. Kara definitely was one, and their sex life had fallen off too, which also put distance between them. He was never in the mood now. He was too tired or not at home when Jane was.
"Maybe he's not the right guy," Alex threw out as a possibility.
She had never been crazy about him, and thought he had a big ego, which didn't seem to bother Jane, but it annoyed Alex.
"Maybe you'd feel more passionate about a different guy," she said cautiously, not wanting to offend Jane.
"I don't think so. I had a hot romance like that in college. It was awful. I cried all the time and lost 15 pounds.
"That's not all bad," Alex grinned, "except the crying part. Sometimes John reminds me of the guy I used to go out with before law school. I liked him and we got along, but it was never really right. And once we started arguing about everything, it was all wrong. I think we just ran out of gas, and then it went sour. If I'd stayed with him, we would have wound up hating each other. We broke up before that happened. Some relationships aren't meant to last forever. Maybe this is one of those."
Jane didn't want to admit it to her, but she had wondered about that too, and their constant arguments now depressed her. She didn't want to fight with him, but she was still hoping it would get better again. They were at each other's throats whenever they were together.
"I don't think we can figure anything out or make any decisions until after we graduate in June," Jane said calmly. "We've never had any major problems until now. He's just in a shit mood and at maximum stress levels all the time, trying to finish everything before graduation. It's not a lot of fun for either of us, and I snap at him, too."
About Kara.
"Doesn't sound like fun to me," Alex agreed.
They walked in the museum garden then, and Jane told her about Marguerite and her search for heirs to the estate. She told her about the jewelry and trying on the enormous diamond ring.
"Wow! It's hard to imagine romances in people like that. They're part of another century. Can you imagine any guy we know giving someone that kind of jewelry, riding around in a race car or living in a chateau? Sounds like a fairy tale or an old movie."
"It is," Jane agreed with her. "And it's sad to think how this story ends up, alone, with dementia in a nursing home in Queens. That sounds like a nightmare to me."
"Yeah. Me too,"
Alex said as they walked into the Calder show and spent a pleasant afternoon, talking about nothing in particular and enjoying each other's company. At 4 o'clock, they said their goodbyes, and Jane took the subway back uptown, and Alex went to the West Village, where she lived in the meatpacking district. She had rented an apartment in a good building in a trendy neighborhood as soon as she got her new job, and she was loving it. And she had a date that night with her new guy to go to the theater. Jane found herself envying her when she went back to the empty apartment and worked on her paper that night. John called her around 9 o'clock and had been at the library all day. They were on separate paths for now, and she tried not to think about what Alex had said at lunch, that John might be the wrong guy. She wasn't ready to believe that yet, and she thought about what she'd said, that some relationships just played themselves out and ended. She hoped that hadn't happened, but the stress on both of them had clearly taken a toll. On Sunday morning, Jane woke up to find John in bed with her, which was beginning to seem like a miracle, and they made love for the first time in a month. She felt better about them after that, and they managed to have brunch at a nearby deli before he went back to the library for the rest of the day and night, but at least the morning had gotten off to a good start, and she felt connected to him again. She went to a movie alone on Sunday night, a French art film she'd been wanting to see, which wasn't as interesting as she hoped, and that night she went to sleep and dreamed of Marguerite. She was trying to say something to Jane and explain something to her, but through the entire troubled night, Jane never figured out what it was. John didn't come home again on Sunday night, and had texted her he'd slept on someone's couch. She got up Monday morning, feeling drained and frustrated, and got ready for another week in surrogates court. At least she had the Christie's appraisal to look forward to the next day. It was a welcome change, and with all that spectacular jewelry, Marguerite's estate was anything but boring. It was the only excitement and bright spot in her life for now. Chapter 4 Philip Lawton left his apartment in Chelsea at the crack of dawn on Saturday morning, as he did every week, to rendezvous with the love of his life. Her name was Sweet Sally. She was an old wooden sailboat he had owned for 8 years, and he kept her in a small harbor on Long Island. He spent every weekend on her, no matter what the weather, and when it was decent, he spent all his time sanding, cleaning, painting. She was immaculate, and no woman had ever given him as much joy. He was fiercely proud of her, and he usually spent Saturday night on her, and Friday night, too, whenever possible. It was a prerequisite that the women he went out with also loved Sweet Sally. Some did more than others. Most women got tired of the boat after a while, and Philip's passion for her. She was the possession he was most proud of. He had loved sailing since he was a boy, even more than he loved art. He was a good sailor, and would often take her out in rough seas or summer storms, but at those times he went alone and didn't expect anyone to go with him. At 34, he had been involved in numerous relationships over the past years, but none either serious or long-term. A few had lasted a year, but most of them ran their course in a few months, and by then he or the woman, or both, had figured out that it was going nowhere and never would. Philip had high ideals about what he wanted in a long-term relationship, and particularly a wife, and his role model was his parents' marriage, which had seemed perfect to him. He compared all relationships to theirs and wanted nothing less for the long haul. His parents had been crazy about each other, until his father's death 3 years before. They had been the ideal complement to each other and fit together seamlessly. The whole relationship had always been characterized by humor, kindness, compassion, tenderness, a profound love for each other, and deep mutual respect. Philip had no sense of how rare that was in today's world and thought it was normal. His father was 10 years his mother's senior. They had met when she took one of his art history classes at NYU. His mother was a serious artist, for whose work his father had the greatest admiration. They had been unable to have children for the first 15 years of their marriage, despite many attempts and several miscarriages, and had finally given up and decided that their relationship was so strong and meaningful to both of them that perhaps they would be happier without children, and had finally accepted their inability to have them. And 6 months later, when his mother turned 40 and his father 50, she had gotten pregnant with Philip, and this time the pregnancy went effortlessly to a successful end. They called him their miracle child, doted on him, and included him in the magic circle of their deep affection for each other. He had grown up bathed in the warmth of their love and approval, and every relationship he had as an adult fell short of the generosity of spirit and sheer joy he had seen between his parents, and he wasn't willing to accept less. And unless he had a relationship like theirs, he had no desire to settle down and was comfortable alone. Maybe too comfortable. His mother had been concerned for several years now that his standards were so high and his idealistic vision of them so strong that he would wind up alone when no one measured up to his parents' marriage. He didn't seem worried about remaining a bachelor and often said that he would prefer to be alone than with a woman who was less than what he wanted. And his mother had suggested to him that he was looking for a female with a halo and wings, which was certainly not who she was. But it was how Philip viewed her, and he stubbornly refused to tolerate any woman's flaws. And by now, he liked his own habits. Adjusting to someone else was not his strong suit. As a result, he spent a lot of time alone on his boat, working diligently on it during the weekends. For now, Sweet Sally was enough for him, or so he claimed. And solitude didn't scare him. He liked it. On Sunday afternoon, after 2 good days of sailing in bright sun and strong winds, he drove into the city to have dinner with his mother at her apartment, as he often did on Sunday nights when neither of them had other plans. She liked to stay busy. She readily admitted that she was a terrible cook and reminded him regularly of one of her many human failings that he chose to overlook. When he came to the apartment to have dinner, she would go to a nearby delicatessen and buy all the things he liked, and they would sit at her kitchen table, talk about her current work, her next gallery show, his discontent with Christie's, or anything else of interest to him. She was more like a friend than a mother to him now, was seldom critical of him, made intelligent suggestions, and at 74 was the most youthful person he knew, with an open mind, a deep knowledge of art she had always shared with him, and fascinating creative ideas. She was never afraid to tackle difficult or controversial subjects, and sometimes preferred them. Valerie had always encouraged her son to think outside the box and explore new concepts and ideas. She hoped that he would meet a woman who would challenge him, enough to conquer his own fears of winding up with the wrong woman, but so far he never had. She thought his expectations of a woman were unrealistic, but she hadn't lost hope for him yet, and hoped the right one would come along and shake him up a little. And he was young enough that there was no rush. But she was also well aware that he had gotten set in his ways and enjoyed his own company too much. Lately, he had gotten lazy about dating, and his obsession with his boat didn't appeal to many women, as she pointed out to him.
"Why don't you go skiing or take up some sport where you'll meet women?"
she prodded him occasionally, and he just laughed at her. She didn't like interfering in his life, but was sorry to see him alone, and didn't want him to stay that way forever.
"I'm not trying to meet women, Mother. I meet women every day."
The kind who sold the gifts men had given them when the marriage or affair ended, and had little respect or affection for the sentiment behind the gifts. They were only interested in the money they would get from selling them at auction. Or he met women who worked in the other departments at Christie's, who were sometimes a little too serious for him. He had gone out with one who was extremely knowledgeable about Gothic and medieval art, and his mother had thought she seemed like a member of the Adams family when she met her, but didn't comment. Philip had come to that conclusion, too, and stopped seeing her shortly after. He had been without a relationship for a year now, since the last one, and most of his friends were married by now and having first or second children. He preferred women his own age to younger ones, and many of them were married. In the meantime, he had Sunday night dinner with his mother whenever she wasn't too busy to see him. He enjoyed her company, and they often laughed at the same things, and he always relaxed in the comfortable chaos of her apartment. All her life, she'd had the ability to turn her surroundings into a magical world. She and Philip's father never had a lot of money, but were comfortable enough and had never lacked for anything. Nor had their son. They were satisfied with what they had. Her circumstances had altered considerably 3 years before, from the insurance policy her husband had left her that she had known nothing about. It had dramatically changed her bank account, but not her life. She still enjoyed doing all the same things, and had never felt deprived by their lack of fortune. She intended to leave most of the insurance money to Philip one day.
She was careful and responsible with it, and hoped it would be useful for him, perhaps to start an art consulting business or a gallery of his own. She had mentioned it to him several times, but he wanted his mother to benefit from the money first. He thought she should travel, enjoy herself, and see the world, but she was too busy painting and still studying to venture far from home. "I'm having too much fun to go anywhere," she would say, laughing at him with her big bright blue eyes and nearly unlined face. She was still energetic, lively, and beautiful at her age. She was blessed with a youthful look and spirit. It was easy to see why her husband had been in love with her till the end. She was an enchanting woman, full of mischief and charm, with a mane of once pale blonde hair that was now snow white, and she often wore it loose down her back, as she had all her life. By contrast, her older sister by 4 years, Winnie, was her opposite in every way. They were the yin and yang of life, but best friends nonetheless. While Valerie had never been concerned with the absence of luxury in her life, Edwina, Winnie, had thought of nothing else and, like their parents, had worried about money and the possible lack of it since she was a young girl. Born the year after Pearl Harbor, Valerie came into the world on the cusp of a more prosperous time. Winnie was born in 1938, 9 years after their family had lost everything in the stock market crash, and she was a child in the years of the Depression and remembered their parents' constant discussions about money. Their family had had a considerable fortune, and both their parents came from aristocratic ancestors, but lost almost everything they had. Winnie's answer to their financial insecurity was to marry a young man from a wealthy family, and she had lived in extremely comfortable circumstances all her adult life. And when her husband died 10 years before, he had left her a considerable fortune, and she still worried. Valerie had simply never cared about money, and always thought that whatever they had was enough. Winnie and Valerie both remembered their father as a kind, though serious and somewhat chilly and austere man. He was a banker and was conservative about money. Losing their fortune had sobered him, and Valerie's recollection of him was of his being at the office most of the time. And her memories of their mother were of an ice-cold woman whose approval she could never win, no matter what she did. They had had an older sister who died of influenza in Europe at 19, whom Valerie didn't remember, as she had died a year after Valerie's birth. Winnie, on the other hand, insisted that she had some vague memories of her and made excuses for their mother's coldness by saying she had never recovered from their sister's death. She would never speak of her first daughter as the younger girls were growing up, and they had rapidly understood that the subject was taboo. It was just too painful for her. Winnie had been born when her older sister was 14, and her arrival had come as an awkward surprise to her parents, which her mother had grudgingly adjusted to. But Valerie's birth 4 years later was simply too much for their mother. She was 45 years old and seemed embarrassed to have a baby at that age rather than pleased. Valerie had felt unwelcome in their midst all her life until she married Lawrence and escaped the family she had nothing in common with. But Winnie was just like them, serious, austere, nervous, humorless, critical, and most of the time cold. She was a dignified woman, always concerned with doing the right thing, but never a warm one. There was nothing spontaneous about her, and she had grown up to be just like her mother. Valerie loved her sister anyway, and had managed to forge a strong bond with her. Valerie spoke to Winnie almost every day and listened to her complain, often about her daughter Penny, who was more like Valerie than her own mother. Penny was an attorney with 3 children of her own, who Winnie thought were rude, unruly, and undisciplined, and she had never liked her son-in-law either. Winnie needed an orderly, peaceful life, unlike her younger sister Valerie, who was open to all possibilities and led what Winnie considered a bohemian life, as their mother had said about her too. But Winnie was more tolerant of her than their mother had been. Valerie had never been able to scale the walls her mother built around her, and eventually gave up long before she died. She had never approved of her youngest daughter, and made that clear. And with a husband and child she adored, Valerie had stopped caring about her mother's disapproval years before. She didn't miss her when she died, although Winnie had mourned her for years, and spoke of their mother as if she had been a saint. And Valerie understood even less, when she had her own child, how her mother hadn't been able to view her arrival as an unexpected blessing,
rather than a curse. Valerie's family had been a mystery to her all her life. Even Winnie, of whom she forgave much, even now, and she often made jokes about having been switched at birth at the hospital with some other family. The greatest difference between them was that Valerie was a warm, loving person, and her parents and even her sister were ice cold. She thought of it as unfortunate for them, and was grateful that her son had inherited none of their traits. Nor had her niece Penny, who was a very sweet girl and a very successful lawyer. She was 10 years older than her cousin Philip, and they were good friends, more like sister and brother since both were only children, and she often called her Aunt Valerie for advice rather than dealing with Winnie, which was always a no-win for her in the face of her mother's criticism of everything she did, including a law degree from Harvard, which her mother thought was inappropriately ambitious for a woman. Penny was a better mother than Winnie claimed. Her philosophies about child-rearing were similar to her aunt's. Winnie was hopelessly old-fashioned in her outlook, whereas Valerie was full of life and always willing to embrace anything new. When Philip arrived for dinner on Sunday night, Valerie was cleaning her brushes and had just finished painting. She was working on a portrait of a woman that had a mystical quality to it, and Philip stood staring at it for a long time. Valerie had real talent as a painter. Her gallery shows got good reviews, and all her pieces sold. She was represented by a respected gallery near her apartment in Soho. They had lived there for as long as Philip remembered, long before it became fashionable, and she enjoyed how lively it had become, and all the young people who lived there. She compared it to the Left Bank in Paris. "I like your new painting, Mom," he said admiringly. It was a subtle change from her previous work. She was always pushing herself to grow as an artist and studying new techniques.
"I'm not sure where I'm going with it. I had a dream about it the other night. The woman in it has been haunting me. It's driving me crazy," she said with a broad smile, looking happy and untroubled. The smell of her paints was heavy in the apartment. It was a familiar part of the artistic ambience around her, along with the bright fabrics and interesting pieces she and his father had collected over the years, some pre-Columbian, others European antiques, some from India, and a number of paintings and sculptures by her artist friends. His father had thrived on the eclectic people she drew to them, and had enjoyed meeting most of them. He had called it a modern-day salon, like those in Paris in the 20s and 30s, or the entourage around Picasso, Matisse, Cocteau, and Hemingway or Sartre. She also collected playwrights and writers, anyone who was steeped in the arts or creative in some way. "I'm sure you'll solve it," he said, referring to the painting. She always did. She put a great deal of thought into her work. They chatted easily while she spread out all his favorite food on the kitchen table. One of her greatest joys in life was spoiling him, in whatever way she could, even with a simple dinner in her kitchen. He was touched by the effort she made. He complained about the jewelry department at Christie's again, and she reminded him that it was up to him to make a change, and not just sit there stagnating, waiting for fate to take a hand. And then he told her about the collection of jewels he was going to see that week, and how impressive they appeared to be from the photographs he had seen.
"Who did they belong to?" she asked with an interested look.
"Some countess who died penniless with a fortune in jewels and no heirs," he said, summing it up for her from the little he knew himself.
"How sad for her," Valerie said, sympathetic for a woman she didn't know, as she pushed her mane of white hair back with a graceful hand, and they sat down to dinner together. And eventually she got around to asking him if he was dating anyone special at the moment. He shook his head.
"Not since the last one I broke up with almost a year ago. I've just had casual dates since then. She hated my boat. I think she was jealous of it."
His mother grinned at what he said.
"I think I would be, too. You spend more time on that boat than with anyone you've gone out with. Women are funny about things like that. They expect you to spend time with them, too."
"Oh, that," Philip said and laughed. "I will spend more time when I meet the right one."
His mother gave him a cynical glance, and he looked sheepish for a minute.
"What's wrong with spending weekends on a sailboat on Long Island Sound?"
"A lot, in freezing weather in the winter. You have to do other things, too, or you'll wind up alone on that boat forever." I was talking to your Aunt Winnie about going to Europe together next summer, by the way, she said, as she handed him a platter of tomatoes and mozzarella with fresh basil leaves on it. But she's not an easy person to travel with, Valerie said about her older sister. Are you going? Philip was curious. I don't know. I love Winnie, but she worries about everything and complains all the time. And everything is scheduled down to the last second. I like trips to be more freeform and make decisions as I go along. That drives Winnie nuts and makes her anxious. We have to stick to her schedule at all times. It's a bit like enlisting in the army. I think I'm getting too old for that, she said, smiling. Or too young. I wouldn't enjoy that either. I don't know how she doesn't drive you insane. Philip had kept his distance from his dour old aunt for years. I love her. That helps make her more tolerable. But traveling in Europe with her might be too much to ask. She had done it before, but always swore she wouldn't do it again. And then she did, mostly out of pity for Winnie, who had no one else to travel with. Both women were widowed, but Valerie had a much larger circle of friends, many of them artists, and in a wide variety of ages. Some of her friends were Philip's age, and others were even older than she was. Valerie didn't care about their age, as long as they were interesting, intelligent, and fun. Philip left shortly after dinner and went back to his apartment to catch up on some work. His mother hugged him warmly, and he had a feeling she was going back to work on the painting of the mysterious woman after he left. And he wasn't wrong. Mother and son knew each other well. "And good luck with that woman's estate this week," she said to him as he was leaving. "It sounds like her jewels would make an impressive auction, particularly if you tell something about her story in the catalogue." She was right, of course, along with using photographs of the Countess wearing some of the pieces, if they had any. It would certainly be more interesting than the heading that the jewelry was being sold by the Surrogate's Court of New York, which they would have to say, too. "Property of a noble woman," he said to his mother, quoting a typical catalog description, and she smiled. "I like the sound of it already. Good luck," she said, and kissed him. "Thanks, Mom. I'll call you. Thanks for dinner." "Anytime," she said, and hugged him again, and a moment later he left. And just as he had suspected, the moment the door closed behind him, she went back to work. She was determined to get further insight into the woman she was painting. Maybe the subject of her canvas was a noble woman, too, she thought to herself, and smiled again. Her work always had a certain mystery to it, and told a story, but sometimes it took her a while to figure out what it was. Chapter 5 Jane arrived at the bank before Philip on Tuesday morning. It was pouring rain, her umbrella had turned inside out as soon as she left the subway, and she was soaked. She felt like a drowned rat. He looked no better when he arrived. He had forgotten his umbrella in the cab he had taken from Christie's, and he was 10 minutes late. Traffic had been awful. She saw him glancing around the lobby of the bank when he got there, trying to figure out who she was. She was talking to Hal Baker, and had spotted Philip immediately, in a dark suit and a Burberry raincoat. She noticed how tall he was, and how businesslike he appeared. He looked more like a banker than an auctioneer. She had forgotten that he would be doing an auction immediately after. She was wearing boots and a down coat that had soaked the water up like a sponge, and black jeans and a heavy sweater. It was windy and cold outside despite the rain. Spring seemed like it was an eternity away, and New York was chilly, wet, and gray. "Miss Willoughby?" Philip asked, looking uncertain as she smiled and nodded, shook his hand, and then introduced him to Hal Baker. Philip seemed personable and polite as the two men greeted each other. "Sorry to bring you out in such awful weather," Jane said apologetically. "I think it might be worth your while, though. The pieces are really beautiful," she said as they followed Hal downstairs to the safe deposit boxes. They didn't need the notary this time, as all the official work had been done, and the inventory had been notarized and was complete. Now all they had to do was make a decision about how to dispose of it. They had stopped running the notices that week, and no heirs, it appeared. Jane thought it was really a shame that no one had surfaced. Hal unlocked the box as he had before, and they followed him into the same cubicle where Jane had first seen the pieces and the other contents of the box. He set the box down on the table and left them there alone. Jane took out the jewelry boxes one by one and set them on the table. Philip began opening them. The first box he opened held a diamond and sapphire brooch from Van Cleef, and he looked visibly impressed. He saw the ruby ring next. He took a jeweler's loop out of his pocket and held it to his eye. "This is a pigeon's blood Burmese ruby," he said to Jane as he looked at it. "It's the finest quality and color there is." He took the loop from his eye then and gazed seriously at her. "I'd say it's about 25 or 30 carats at a guess. It is incredibly rare to find a ruby of this quality and that size. It's a knockout and would sell for a fortune." He examined the emerald ring after that, which he guessed was about the same size as the ruby, or slightly larger, and declared it to be first-rate as well. He placed it back in its box with great care, and opened the box with the diamond ring next, which was even larger, and this time he smiled. "Wow," he said, sounding like a kid, and she laughed. "That's what I said when I saw it," she admitted, and then looked sheepish. "I tried it on," she confessed, and he grinned as he imagined it. "How did it look?" He teased her a little. This was suddenly fun. The jewels were fabulous, and if the surrogate's court sold them with Christie's, it was going to be a fantastic sale. "It looked pretty good. It's the closest I'll ever get to a rock this size," she said, smiling back at him. "How big is it?" "Probably about 40 carats, depending on how deep it is. That's just a guess." But he had gotten good at estimating size and quality of stones during his 2 years in the jewelry department, and had taken a basic gemology class to educate himself. These were the finest pieces he'd seen so far. He studied the invisibly set sapphire necklace and earrings from Van Cleef, and the pearls, which he said were natural, which made them incredibly valuable too, and the tiara, the pearl and diamond antique choker from Cartier, and the pieces from Bulgari in Rome. He went through all of it in under an hour and looked at Jane when he was finished, deeply impressed. "Until I saw the photographs, I figured all you had here was junk. And once I saw the pictures, I knew it would be good stuff, but I didn't expect quality like this. And no heirs have come forward at all?"
"None," she said sadly. "Would you like to see the photographs of the Countess? She was a beautiful young woman."
She took them out, and they went through them together. He pointed out where she was wearing the jewelry. There were several photos. And what struck Jane again was how happy she looked with the handsome Count, and how much he seemed to love her as he gazed at her adoringly.
"He appears to be old enough to be her father," Philip commented.
"He was 38 years older,
Jane responded. She had figured it out from his obituary and her passports.
"What were their names again?" "He was Count Umberto Vincenzo Alessandro di San Pignelli, and her maiden name was Marguerite Wallace Pearson, di San Pignelli, once they married. She was 18 then, and he was 56.
Jane looked wistful as they stared at the photographs together, and Philip glanced at Jane in surprise.
"It's a fairly common name, but my mother's maiden name was Pearson, too. Maybe they were distantly related, cousins or something. Although it's probably just a coincidence. There was no Marguerite that I know of. I'll have to tell my mom. I'm not suggesting that she's an heir," he said, looking embarrassed. "It's just an odd coincidence of name. She's never mentioned a relative who married an Italian count, and the countess was a generation older than my mom. Maybe she was a distant cousin of her father's, or more likely, no relation at all."
But the name had sparked his interest, though not as much as the jewels and the fabulous auction and buzz they would create. He hadn't seen jewels like that in all the time he'd been there, and they had sold some beautiful things in the past 2 years.
"Who should I speak to about an auction?"
he asked Jane directly.
"My boss, Harriet Fine. I'm just a temporary clerk. I'm finishing law school in June."
"NYU?" he asked with interest.
"Columbia. I had to do an internship or clerk for a court to finish. Surrogate's court hasn't been too entertaining, till now,"
she admitted to him, as Hal Baker came back and locked up the safe deposit box again, and they followed him out.
"All the clerkships I wanted were taken, family court and criminal, so I got this. I took it instead of probate, which would have been worse."
She smiled ruefully, and so did he in answer.
The jewelry department at Christie's isn't much better. They transferred me from the art department 2 years ago, which felt like a prison sentence. Although, I have to admit, this auction would be spectacular. Are they talking to any other auction houses? He asked, and she shook her head. No, just you. Christie's was my boss's first choice. She told me to call you, so I did. I'm glad you like Countess di San Pignelli's things. I think they're beautiful, too. They're better than beautiful. They are all of the finest quality. It's rare to see pieces of that caliber with such important stones. The Count and Countess must have led quite a life.
It looks like it from the photographs, Jane said quietly.
I wonder what happened after that, he said, curious. It was impossible not to wonder about her and the Count.
I wish I knew, too. They looked so happy together, although she had sad eyes.
Did she? Philip was surprised. I didn't notice. I was too distracted by the stones.
He smiled, thinking that Jane was an interesting woman. He'd expected to meet some boring, humdrum clerk. She was a vast improvement over that.
What happens now? Jane asked him when they were standing in the lobby of the bank again, and Hal had left them to go back to his desk.
My boss speaks to yours, Philip explained. We make a bid to sell the pieces, negotiate our fee, and discuss the catalog with them. If they like what we have to say, they consign the pieces to us, and we put them in our next magnificent jewel sale, probably in May, September, or December, right before the holidays. We would do a whole section about her with some of the photographs and try to make it sound romantic and appealing, and then we sell them, take our portion of the hammer price from the seller and the buyer, and turn the rest over to the state. It's pretty straightforward, unless an heir shows up, of course, but it doesn't sound like that's going to happen from what you've said.
She had told him about going to the nursing home and the Countess's old apartment building in the city while he was photographing the jewelry for his files, so he could show his boss what kind of story they could build in the catalog, even though she wasn't well known. But a Countess had some magic to it, and the jewels spoke for themselves. He didn't need to make a hard sell.
None of it will probably happen before I go back to school, she said quietly, thinking about it. I'll have to keep an eye out for the auction, or maybe someone could let me know.
She had taken a personal interest in this, and he could see it.
You should come to the auction. A sale like this will be very exciting.
Will you be the auctioneer? She was curious about him.
I doubt it. This sale will be too important. It will be part of a bigger sale, but it will certainly be one of the highlights. Important jewelers and collectors will be bidding from all over the world on the phone, and some of them will be in the room. It would be quite an experience for you to see it. And opportunities like this wouldn't come her way often. She was pensive before she answered.
I think it might make me too sad.
He was touched by what she said. She really cared about this woman, although she had never known her.
It seems so heartbreaking that she died alone, with no family around her.
Philip nodded, not sure what to say, as they left the bank together. The rain had finally stopped.
Can I give you a lift?
He offered as he hailed a cab.
No, thanks. I'll take the subway back to the office. I'll tell my boss that Christie's would be interested in selling the pieces at auction. I'm sure she'll call you.
If she doesn't, I'll call her. I might anyway. We wouldn't want this sale to get away from us, he said, as he opened the door of the cab.
Thank you for coming, she said politely, and he smiled as he closed the door and waved as they drove off.
He had been bowled over by everything he'd seen that morning, the jewels and the girl.
Chapter 6
When Philip got back to the office, he had to get ready for the jewelry sale they were doing at noon, and he only had half an hour to prepare. It was not an important sale, and was listed under the heading Fine Jewels, which was a far cry from the magnificent jewels he had just seen, in a whole other category. And he realized he would have to discuss them with his superiors after the noon auction. He didn't have time now to do them justice, and he wanted to show them the photographs he had taken. The sale he ran at noon went smoothly, but took longer than expected, and it was 4:30 before he walked into the office of the head of the jewelry department. Ed Barlow was looking over a list of the hammer prices from that afternoon and seemed pleased. He glanced up at Philip.
"Nice sale," he commented, as he set the list down on his desk. "What's up?"
he asked, pointing to a chair and inviting Philip to sit down.
I looked at an abandoned estate today with a clerk of the Surrogate's Court. It's a collection of extraordinary pieces, all by major jewelers, he said quietly, as he handed Ed the photographs he had just printed out, and he watched Ed's face as he sifted through them, examining each one. He looked startled when he glanced back at Philip.
Are these pieces as good as they look?
Better. The photographs don't do them justice, Philip said calmly. It was the first time he'd enjoyed working in the department in 2 years. This was like discovering oil or finding gold. Even if they weren't his, it was exciting to be part of it, and hopefully have a role to play in the sale.
Do we know the provenance?
His boss asked him. We have a name and some photographs. She was a young American girl who was married to an Italian count from 1942 till 1965. Probably a young heiress. She died without money or heirs. All she had were the jewels, which the bank discovered when they drilled open the box.
Is everything in order?
Ed asked with concern.
Were all the time restrictions respected?
Diligently. The box was abandoned 3 years ago. The bank drilled it open after 13 months and sent a registered letter in the right time frame. They waited 2 years after that, notified the Surrogate's Court, and they've placed ads to locate the heirs. None have turned up. I saw all the records myself.
Good.
Ed seemed pleased as he sat behind his desk, an enormous antique partner's desk that Christie's had purchased years before.
I don't want slip-ups with pieces like this. Why don't you call the clerk of the court and discuss our fees with them, just so everything is clear? I'd like to schedule it for the May sale. There's still time to photograph them. We can just squeak under the wire and get these into the catalog. Make sure you call her right away.
I'll take care of it first thing tomorrow morning, Philip assured him, and left Ed's office with the Pignelli file in his hand. It was too late to call them today. It was after 5, and as a government office, he knew they'd be closed. He was tempted to call Jane to tell her, but it would be improper to discuss it with her before they came to an agreement with Harriet, so it would have to wait, although he hoped their paths would cross again. And the next day, as he had promised Ed he would, he called Harriet, per Jane's suggestion, had a frank discussion with her, said they were interested in selling the pieces, and quoted their fees of 10% from the seller on the hammer price, with the rest of the proceeds going to the state. And the cost of photography for the catalog would have to be paid for by the Surrogate's Court, which didn't surprise Harriet. She was used to it, since they put items up for auction all the time. He told her they would want to use some of the photographs of the Countess in the catalog to help hype the sale, if Harriet didn't mind. She didn't care. It was fine with her. And she promised to get back to him with a decision by the end of the week. He told her that they were a little pressed for time to get the items into the catalog for the May sale. She said she'd see what she could do, and Philip wondered if she'd shop it around and get quotes from Sotheby's, too. But Jane had said it would be unlikely, since Harriet had suggested Christie's herself. So all he could do now was wait for their answer and hope the Surrogate's Court placed the items with them. They'd be a fabulous addition to any sale. He still hadn't heard from them on Friday, but didn't want to push, and he decided to wait until Monday to call Harriet again, although Ed inquired about it on Friday afternoon. Philip spent the weekend on his boat, as usual, and dropped by his mother's apartment on Sunday afternoon on his way home. He wasn't staying for dinner, since Valerie had told him she was going to dinner with friends. Someone else had invited her to the ballet, and she'd declined. She poured tea for both of them, and they spent a few minutes together before she had to leave. She was already dressed for the evening, and looked very nice in jeans and a heavy black sweater with heels, and she was wearing makeup.
"How did your week go?"
she asked him with interest, and he told her about the jewelry he had seen, and Christie's wanting to include it in a sale. He told her he hadn't had an answer from the clerk of the Surrogate's Court yet, but was planning to pursue it again the next day.
"The jewelry must be impressive if Christie's wants to sell it," Valerie said, finishing her tea.
And then he remembered the coincidence of names.
"The woman's maiden name is the same as yours, by the way," he said with amusement.
"Though I doubt we're related to this woman," he added, and she nodded.
"It's a pretty common name. I'm afraid we don't have any relatives who'd own that kind of jewelry, although it would be nice if we did."
She smiled at him, but they both knew that she wasn't dazzled by it, and money was never a strong motivating force to her, particularly other people's. His mother had never been a greedy woman, and had always been satisfied with what she had.
"I think the prices on this sale will go through the roof,"
The pieces are incredibly beautiful, with big stones of high quality. It's going to be an exciting sale, if the court lets us have it.
I'm sure they will. Why wouldn't they?
Valerie said reassuringly as she stood up.
Now I have to go.
You never know. They might get a better deal from another auction house.
I hope not, she said loyally.
He thought for a second about telling her about meeting Jane, but he felt stupid doing it. He'd probably never see Jane again. So he stood up, hugged his mother, and kissed her goodbye, and promised to call her soon. Have fun tonight, he said as she closed the door, and he got in the elevator. The next morning he called Harriet Fine again. She apologized for not getting back to him. She had been waiting for clearance from her own supervisors to proceed with the sale, and she had just gotten it an hour before.
It's a go, she said quietly. They've accepted your terms for the sale.
That's fantastic, Philip said, sounding excited. I'd like to pick up the pieces in the next few days so we can photograph them for the catalog. May I have your authorization for the bank?
I'll take care of it right away, Harriet assured him. I'll notify the bank. Will you pick them up yourself?
Yes, I'll probably bring a security guard with me with a town car. After that, should I keep them in our safe at Christie's pending the sale, or do you want them returned to the court?
It all sounded like a headache she didn't want or need, and this was much bigger than any sale she'd dealt with before.
And Christie's was certainly reliable and trustworthy to keep the jewels in their vault until the sale.
I'd prefer that you keep them until the auction. I'll send a clerk over to ensure that the transfer goes smoothly the day you pick them up. Just let me know when you plan to do it.
He thought about it for a moment and checked his calendar before he spoke. The following morning was clear.
Would tomorrow be too soon?
He asked hesitantly.
I could be there when the bank opens at 9.
And with luck, he could get them to the photographer by 10, so they could get started.
That will be fine. I'll have the clerk bring all the documents and photographs back to us, but the jewelry is yours.
He knew Ed Barlow would be pleased.
I'll want to reproduce some of those old photographs, he reminded her.
That's fine, she said simply. There were no family members to object, and it seemed all right to her, if it would help the sale. This was all about business now, for the state. She was always diligent about defending their interests.
I'll have my clerk at the bank at 9, she confirmed, and a moment later she walked into Jane's office and told her she had to be at the bank the next morning to collect the documents from the safe deposit box and observe the transfer of the jewels to the representative from Christie's. Jane wondered if it would be Philip again. She wasn't sure and didn't want to ask. She had liked talking to him and examining Marguerite's jewels and photographs with him, and she liked the idea of seeing him again, if it worked out that way. If not, that was all right, too. And from what Harriet had said, she gathered that the Christie's sale was moving forward. She mentioned it to John that night. He had finished another paper and had a hamburger with her at a nearby diner before going back to the library to do some more work. She felt like they hadn't had a decent conversation or dinner together in weeks. Instead of catching up on each other's news at dinner, she had the sense that they had become disconnected. It was an unhappy feeling, and all she could hope now was that their relationship would come back to life in June. It was the light at the end of the tunnel, and until then, she was trying to be patient and supportive. He was like a phantom roommate. But in 3.5 months, it would be over. She could hardly wait for their life to pick up where it had left off. He was beginning to seem like a stranger. And he didn't seem interested when she told him the jewels she had been mentioning were being put up for auction at Christie's. They were just too far from anything he cared about, and not on his radar screen at all. He went back to the library after dinner, and she went home, wishing that their relationship was still the same as it had been 6 months before. But it just wasn't. He seemed less and less connected to her every day. He was still sleeping soundly when Jane left the apartment and took the subway downtown the next morning. She got to the bank just as Philip Lawton got out of a town car with a driver. She noticed that there was a security guard in the front seat. Philip was wearing a blazer and slacks, a crisp blue shirt, and a good-looking dark blue Hermes tie under a well-cut navy overcoat, and he seemed pleased to see her. They stood chatting outside the bank for a few minutes, waiting for the doors to open. They had both arrived 5 minutes early. "It sounds like everything's on track for the sale at Christie's," Jane said as she smiled at him. She was wearing a short gray skirt and a peacoat, and she was fresh and bright in the morning sun, as her neatly brushed hair hung past her shoulders, and he noticed that she was wearing small gold earrings. The doors of the bank opened, and Philip motioned to the Christie's security guard to join them. He had brought two large leather cases to put the jewels in, and the guard from Christie's followed them inside and down to the safe deposit boxes. Jane had to sign several sets of papers to take responsibility for emptying the box on behalf of the surrogate's court. And then Philip had to sign another set to her, acknowledging receipt of the 22 pieces of jewelry he would take with him to consign to Christie's. It took several minutes to get all the papers in order, and then Jane took out the jewelry boxes and handed them to Philip one by one. He had signed a copy of the inventory as well. Jane then put all the documents in a large manila envelope she had brought with her, with the seal of the surrogate's court on it. She put the letters, passports, and bank statements in it, and then she and Philip sifted through the photographs. He selected half a dozen that he thought would reproduce well. One of the count and countess in front of the chateau, another of them in evening clothes, where she was wearing the sapphire necklace and earrings, a beautiful one of Marguerite alone, also in an evening gown, another of them on horseback, and one skiing, and a sweet one of her in the tiara, looking very young. The photographs established them as a golden couple, and had all the elegance and glamour of a bygone era. And then Jane sat looking at the photographs of the little girl.
"I wonder who she was," Jane said softly.
"Maybe a younger sister," Philip suggested.
"Or a child who died. Maybe that's why Marguerite looked so sad."
Jane guessed about the countess, frustrated that they would never know. There was so much they didn't know about the woman who had owned the jewels. Why had she left the States during the war and gone to Italy? How had she gotten there, since her entry point into Europe had been England via Lisbon, according to the stamp in her passport? How had she met the count, and when had they fallen in love, and what had she done between 1965, when the count died, and 1994, when she moved back to New York? And what had made her come back? The address on her documents had been a Roman one after 1974, so what had happened to the chateau? Jane wished that there was someone who could tell them and explain it all. Marguerite had left no trace of her past except the photographs, two sets of letters, her addresses at different times, and the jewels. "I guess some questions are never answered, and some mysteries are never solved," Philip said thoughtfully, as he watched Jane put the photographs of the little girl into the envelope of documents and photographs he wasn't borrowing. Jane sealed the envelope carefully so nothing would fall out, and she had written Marguerite's full name on it to turn over to Harriet when she got back, as her documents had to be preserved for 7 years in case relatives eventually turned up. Jane didn't know what would happen to them after that, if they would be archived or destroyed. It made her sad again to think about it, and she had all the releases Philip had signed to give to Harriet as well. And as they stood up in the now familiar cubicle, the security guard from Christie's picked up one of the leather bags. Philip picked up the other one, and Jane followed them out. The empty safe deposit box was sitting on the desk. Hal came to say goodbye to them as they left. He almost seemed like a friend now, in this unusual adventure they had embarked on, to auction off Mrs. Pignelli's jewels. Philip offered Jane a ride again, and she declined. He promised to call her when they had reproduced the photographs and returned them to her at the court. They drove away a moment later as Jane headed toward the subway with a thick envelope in her arms. She was feeling pensive as she thought about the documents in her possession and the jewelry Philip had just taken. The last remnants of Marguerite de San Pignelli's life were about to be sold. It was a somber thought as she hurried down the subway steps to go back to the court. Chapter 7. On Thursday, Philip's mother called and asked if he wanted to go to a black tie event with her at the Metropolitan Museum that evening. It was an elegant dinner that the Costume Institute gave every year, and she was on the board. Her sister was supposed to go with her, but she canceled at the last minute with a bad cold. Winnie was a hypochondriac and always had some minor ailment or other, and she didn't like to go out when she was sick.
"I'm sorry to ask you so late,"
his mother apologized.
But I have the tickets, and I hate to go alone.
He thought about it for a minute, and then agreed. It was nice to be able to do something for her. Valerie was very independent, led a busy life, and rarely asked anything of her son. And she told him she thought he'd enjoy it. He had been to the same dinner with her once a few years before, right after his father died. It was an impressive event, and he knew that the tickets cost a fortune. It was one of the nice things she could do with the money she got from her husband's insurance. Now she went every year and treated her sister to the ticket. His Aunt Winnie would never have spent the money, although she could afford to, far more so than his mother. He picked Valerie up at her apartment that night, and she was wearing a simple black evening gown, which showed off her still trim figure, and a silver fox jacket that she had had for years, and it still looked glamorous on her. Seeing her, he was suddenly reminded of the photographs of the Countess that he had picked up from the photographer that afternoon. His mother looked nothing like her, but they had the same aristocratic elegance of another time. And he was proud to be with her, as she took his arm and followed him to the town car he had hired for the evening.
"Darling, you spoiled me," she said, smiling at him like a delighted child. "I thought we'd take a cab."
"Certainly not," he said, as he slipped onto the back seat beside her. He was wearing a well-cut tuxedo he'd had made at Savile Row in London, the last time he'd been there for an auction.
"You look very handsome," she commented, as they headed uptown to the Met,
and when they arrived, he saw that the cream of New York was there in full regalia, including the governor and the mayor, and it was, in fact, the glittering event she had promised. They were seated at a table that included one of the curators of the Costume Institute, a well-known fashion designer, and a famous artist, and the conversation was lively. Philip was next to a young woman who had produced a successful play on Broadway, and they talked about theater and art all evening. He would have been interested in her, and she was very attractive, but he was disappointed to discover that she was there with her husband, who was a writer, and had just published his first book. It reminded him of how active his mother was, and the crowd she moved in. She was a very unassuming woman, but she had a natural grace that was timeless and ageless, and he had noticed more than one man admiring her that evening. They were among the last to leave, and talked animatedly about the party on the way home.
"I had a terrific time," he said, and meant it. "The woman I sat next to was great, and I thought the man you sat next to was very nice."
"It's always a fun night," she said, still lively and full of energy. "I didn't even have a chance to ask you what you've been up to. How are you doing with the sale of that woman's jewelry, the one married to the Italian Count?"
she asked him with a warm smile. "The surrogate's court consigned the pieces to us on Tuesday. We've been photographing them all week.
I don't know what it is, but there is something about that woman that is so haunting, maybe because we know so little about her. It's fertile ground for one's imagination."
"Are you sure you're not related to her? It's so odd that you both have the same maiden name."
"Along with about 10 million other people with Anglo-Saxon origins, I'm sure the New York phone book has 10 pages of Pearsons, not to mention Boston. But if I claim her as a relative, do I get some of her jewelry?"
She grinned at her son mischievously. "All of it," he said happily.
"What was her first name?"
Valerie asked casually. She didn't have even the remotest thought that they were related. Just as she said, it was a very common name, and she had no relatives who had gone to Italy and married a count around that time. It was the sort of thing she would have known. No one in her family had ever lived in Europe. They were all firmly planted in New York, and had been for generations.
"It was Marguerite," Philip answered as they drove downtown, and Valerie looked surprised.
"Now, that is a coincidence," she said brightly, but still unimpressed. "There were dozens of them in our family. It was my oldest sister's name, and my grandmother's and great-grandmother's. It was a popular name in those days, at the beginning of the 20th century. And I think Pearson is almost as common as Smith. What a shame."
She laughed as she looked at Philip, who was surprised as well. He had only heard his great-grandmother referred to as Maggie, and never knew his great-great-grandmother's first name.
"You'll have to show me the catalog when you have it. I'd love to see her jewels,"
his mother said wistfully. "I'll give you a catalog when I have them. She was very beautiful, and the Count was very dashing.
I wish we knew more about them, but we just don't. I have to research the jewelry now. Cartier keeps records on every piece they ever made. I'm going to ask them to check their archives to see if they have any information that might help the sale. I have to go to Paris next month, and I was planning to go and see them myself, to look for the working drawings in their archives.
Now, that sounds very exciting, his mother commented, as the car stopped in front of her building.
The doorman opened the door for her, and she kissed Philip, thanked him for joining her, and disappeared into the building. And on the drive uptown, he thought of Marguerite again and the email he wanted to send to Cartier, and then his mind drifted to Jane. He was going to return the original photographs to her the next day. He wondered if it was an adequate excuse to invite her to lunch. He wanted to see her again. He still hadn't mentioned her to his mother, but there was nothing to say except that she was a temporary clerk at the surrogate's court. He knew nothing else about her except that she was graduating from law school, but she seemed intelligent and pleasant to talk to, and he wanted to know more. He was sitting at his desk the next day, thinking about Jane, with the photographs of Marguerite in front of him, when he decided to call her and use that as an excuse. He had nothing to lose, and maybe something to gain if she agreed to lunch. He called the phone number he had for her at the surrogate's court, and Jane answered on the first ring.
"Jane Willoughby,"
she said in a smooth, even voice, and for a fraction of an instant he didn't know what to say, and then told her he'd called to tell her the photographs were ready to send back to her. "I could messenger them over to you today, or if you like," he said, trying to sound calm, "I could give them to you at lunch." He suddenly felt foolish for asking, and was sure she'd refuse. "Or does that sound ridiculous?" he asked, with the odd sensation of being 14 years old. He hadn't been on a date in 3 months, and it seemed awkward. Why would she accept?
"That sounds very nice." Jane seemed surprised. "I could pick the photographs up," she said, feeling strange too.
But she was sure it was innocent and only business. Philip was just being cordial after their common interest in Marguerite.
"I'll give them to you at lunch," he said, since she hadn't rebuffed him, hung up, or laughed into the phone, which he had almost expected her to do.
He wished he were free that day, but he wasn't. He had to attend a department meeting at 1 o'clock to discuss upcoming sales.
"What about Monday? Does that work for you?"
"Yes, it does," she said pleasantly,
reminding herself not to assume that he meant anything by it. It was just lunch. "If you meet me at the office, there's a nice little restaurant nearby. I'll keep the photographs in the safe till then."
"That would be fine," she said with a lilt in her voice, and then added, "Have a nice weekend,"
after he told her to come to Christie's at noon.
"Thank you. You too."
They hung up a moment later, and Philip sat staring out the window, thinking about her, wondering what she'd be doing until he saw her on Monday, and if she had a boyfriend or was unattached. The next day, Jane was still feeling slightly awkward about their lunch date, and mentioned it casually to Alex when they met for lunch at Baltazar, and were going to a movie afterward. John was with his study group in the Hamptons for the weekend. It didn't sit well with Jane, but she hadn't complained about it, knowing it would only heighten the tension between them. He was paying for a share of the house, but never invited Jane to join him. He said it was exclusively for the use of the study group.
"I think I may have done something stupid yesterday," Jane confessed as they finished burgers that were sinfully good.
"Like what? Slept with your boss?"
Alex looked amused.
"My boss is a woman, and she's hell on wheels. Sometimes I think she hates me," Jane said about Harriet, and was thinking about Philip's invitation to lunch. "No, I met a guy over this case I've been working on. He works at Christie's in the jewelry department, and we consigned some jewelry to him to sell for the state. I've only met him twice, and he invited me to lunch."
"And you turned him down?"
Alex was instantly disappointed.
"No, I accepted. I'm having lunch with him on Monday, but he's not some fusty old guy from an auction house. I hope he didn't mean it as a date."
"Are you kidding? Is he young, single, and attractive?"
Jane nodded with a smile on her face. "He's young and attractive. I don't know if he's single, but I assume he is. He acts like it."
Then why the hell not have lunch with him? Why wouldn't you? Just go to lunch,
Alex said with a determined look.
You're not going to have sex with him at a restaurant. You need some distraction at least, and male attention. What's he like?
Alex was curious about him and pleased for her friend. Her relationship with John was such a wasteland at the moment. She felt that an opportunity like that was long overdue. Alex thought she needed to meet other men, and John had been miserable to be with for months.
He's good-looking, intelligent, well-dressed. His background is in art, but he wound up in jewelry at Christie's, and he doesn't like it. But he seems to know a lot about it. He's just a nice guy.
Jane looked ill at ease as she said it, still worried that she'd done the wrong thing by accepting lunch with him. She was